This conference will now be recorded.
Right, hello everybody, and welcome to this special PBIC teleclass because I have a special guest to start off the new year. This will be going out in January, Simon. So I might as well introduce you straight away, seeing as far as I've mentioned your first name. I'm talking to somebody who, well, time, Simon, you come on, you tell us who you are and what you do. What is your superpower?
Hi. What do I do? I call it sports psychology. Some people don't call it sports psychology because we don't do it in sport. So they might call it performance coaching. But essentially what I do is help people to get their mental game right. I do that with athletes and sports teams, and I've been doing that for over 20 years now. But I also have been working with businesses in education, in the charity sector, healthcare, all sorts of fields, doing exactly the same thing, helping people to understand what goes on between their ears, and optimize that so that they get their performance right.
Fabulous, fabulous. And I hooked up with you. We've been Facebook friends for a while, but I hooked up with you because we have a mutual friend, Alex Wardle, who my guys know very well because they've heard him talk a few times. He's videoed quite a few of your events, hasn't he, over the last couple of years?
He has, yeah. He first came out to Warsaw a couple of years ago. He also re recorded an event we did in Newcastle and then Rome during the summer, and most recently in Dublin at the beginning of November. All different events, but working with entrepreneurs to help entrepreneurs to take on their challenges better. We sort of term it thinking and acting like really successful entrepreneurs.
Right, cool. Yeah, so all my guys will be thinking, why aren't you doing events all over Europe like what Simon has done? Why are we stuck in the UK for your events? So I'll have to sort that out next year. But so this is it's fair to say that this, because obviously you started off talking about sports psychology, but now you working as well with charities and businesses and stuff like that. What you teach applies to so many different things, doesn't it?
I mean, I got a bit of a light bulb moment years and years ago when I was challenged to apply what I did, which at the time I still thought of as sports psychology, to a sales team. They were a team of insurance salespeople, and the sales director called me up. He said, "We've got this challenge," and literally, December 31st was kicking over to January the 1st. And the challenge was essentially to go from £1 million ahead in sales to 1.5 million. And he said the problem is they only just scraped the 1 million last year. And the problem, real problem, is I don't think they can do this, and nor do they. Can you help? So I said to him, I don't know, honestly. I've never worked with salespeople before. I've only worked with athletes, but why don't we give it a try? And we did some sessions with them. They all flew past their targets at the end of the year, and it was the kind of real light bulb moment for me was that this stuff that I call sports psychology really isn't. It's really human psychology, human performance psychology. And therefore, if it applies to a sales team as well, would it also maybe apply to teachers? And if it did, would it apply to doctors? And if it did, would it apply to business people and entrepreneurs? And it's that understanding really that's allowed me to take what I do to a far wider audience than just athletes and sports teams.
Yeah, fabulous. I'm going to ask you about teams a little bit later on, actually, because I know you've got some your tips for sort of teams, and for to get teams working better together. And I do feel like we certainly with my higher level coaching groups, even though they're all individuals, they're all w working individually on their own business and stuff. We act as like a team, So I'll be interested to see that side of it as well. But let's go back a little bit in time now. Tell us a bit about you. Family life, where you're from, what was life like growing up for little Simon?
Okay, well, little Simon grew up in a little village, nice little rural community in deepest, darkest Somerset. Very, very ordinary. I was, kind of an all very ordinary kid from a very ordinary middle class family. I was a B grade student. I didn't stick out really in any way. I enjoyed playing football and rugby, and as most kind of kids my age did, and enjoyed getting muddy and climbing trees and all those sorts of things. But I was very much sort of middle of the pack really when I was a kid.
Yeah, cool. So, and so what hobbies, interests, just what you just said, general little boy stuff? Anything you're particularly passionate about?
I mean, I was in the Cubs and Scouts. I enjoyed fishing when I was a kid. I really enjoyed playing sports. I also found actually quite early on that I started coaching sports as well. I was, you know, sort of in Scouts and maybe the early sort of Venture Scouts. So I was somewhere between 14, 17, 18 when I was coaching the Cub Scout football team. So I've been coaching sort of habitually, I guess, for many, many years. The other thing that I noticed, you know, looking back on it now anyway, that stuck out a little bit is that I've always had this entrepreneurial streak. When I was probably early teens, I had a paper round like many kids. And then I got asked if I wanted to do another paper round. And eventually I got too many paper rounds to be able to physically do myself. So I started subcontracting out some paper rounds. And the lady down the road used to refer to me as the newspaper baron. Not quite on the scale of some of our media barons today, but, you know, I had a few newspaper rounds and you know, lots of the kids in the village were actually delivering the papers. And I started this little, you know, car washing business. Soap and Suds was my car washing business. When I was at university, I set myself up when I was in my third year of my bachelor's degree and during my master's, I set myself up a little business to do sport consultancy with semi-professional teams. You know, I used to do things like I organized the varsity rugby match. I played rugby league at university in Leeds, and I went to Leeds Metropolitan, which is the former Polytechnic, and our big derby game of course was against Leeds University, and we were actually the number one and number two teams in the country at the time, university teams. And I asked one of the guys one day, why don't we play our match at Headingley Stadium, where Leeds Rugby League play their matches, you know, big professional stadium. And he said, well, because nobody ever has. I said, yeah, but wouldn't it be great if we could?
Well, that's not a very good reason.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, I said, well, why haven't we got a sponsor on our shirts? And he said, well, because we've never had a sponsor. I said, well, you know, there's a big sports superstore opened up in the center of Leeds. Why don't we go and ask them if they'll sponsor our kit? And, you know, I suppose I just sort of perceived and thought about these things slightly differently from maybe what I would now maybe think of as an entrepreneurial point of view. I guess there was you know, there was a bit of idiosyncrasy in me at that point.
Yeah, for sure. Yes, I was going to ask you actually, was there anything that happened that might have contributed to your sort of career path that you found yourself on now? But I guess it's been a kind of gradual thing. It always sounds like you've had a drive, an ambitious drive, but also sounds like you've enjoyed helping people as well.
Yeah, that very much so. I mean, the other thing that interestingly happened whilst I was a kid, I always dreamed of being a pilot. My dad was in the Navy, in the Fleet Air Arm, which is the bit of the Navy that fly jets and helicopters and things. So we were always in and around air stations when I was a kid. And I used to, you know, dream about one day being a pilot. And when I was 17, I took a flying aptitude test. It's actually run by the RAF, and it essentially it tells you whether you've got the coordination, the sort of hand-eye coordination, and the ability to orientate yourself in space. And so I took this test, and there are three levels. The top level, you can be a pilot. Second level, you're either an observer or a navigator. So essentially you sit in the back seat or sit next to the pilot and monitor systems and stuff like that. And then the third level, you can be an air traffic controller if you've got no coordination whatsoever and no ability to orientate yourself. So they told me I'd reach level three and I could be an air traffic controller, which I didn't really like the sound of. I didn't see
it's not quite as glamorous, is it?
No, my future staring at, you know, a big dial on a screen in front of me. I ditched that idea at age 17. And interestingly, I'd taken A-level maths and physics because I was told by the careers teacher, if you want to be a pilot, you need A-level maths and physics. So I took them, didn't like them, and flunked them as soon as I failed this flying aptitude test, because the reason to pass them had disappeared. So I had to retake my A-levels, and I'd come to the conclusion that the ones I was good at were the ones I was interested in. So I there was an A level in sports studies, and I decided that I'd take this A level in sports studies. I also noticed miraculously, whereas I was absolutely garbage at physics, and you know, if it was the physical properties of throwing something, you know, trajectory and all that sort of stuff to predict, you know, how high it's going to go and where it's going to land and all that sort of stuff. I couldn't do it if it was an object, but if it's a javelin or a discus, now I can do it.
Wow, so it
Exactly
changed.
the same equations. I was garbage at biology, but if it's called exercise physiology and it's about how the heart pumps blood around the body, now I can do it because I'm interested. So I took sports studies and flew sports studies, and also then decided that I'd go and study sports science at university. And that's really what kind of kicked off my career path, as it were.
Yeah, cool. So, and then, so how did that then from sports science, or is sports science tied to sports psychology? I don't
Yeah, so
know.
sports
Yeah.
psychology is a discipline within sports science.
Okay,
And
cool.
as you progress through sports science, you start making choices to bias your studies towards one discipline or another. So I started narrowing everything down towards psychology, which I never expected, honestly. When I first started at university, I expected to be a natural scientist, a physiologist, or a biomechanist, because I was always sort of more interested in definite answers and hard science. But one of my tutors just asked me some really, really interesting questions that you know, kind of just hit a point, you know, a little node in my brain, and sparked up some curiosity, and it was that really that started me down the path of sports psychology.
What was it? Do you
And
remember?
then yeah, I mean, he would ask things like, there are some theories in sports psychology. One of them, it's called the drive theory, states that the more kind of anxious, aroused, excited you become, the better your performance is, or the worse your performance is. Another one called the inverted U says that you get to a point where there's a peak at which you can be sort of aroused or anxious or excited or whatever, and if you go past that peak, it starts to deteriorate. Another one, catastrophe theory, says that once you get to that peak, even if you go a millimeter the other side, you're going to crash into a hole. We were looking at these theories. This was in my first year. I mean, this is sort of really basic sort of theories of arousal and anxiety. And he asked this question. He said, "Are any of these actually true? Is that what actually goes on between the ears of a performer when they're in competition?" And I thought, what a great question. I don't know. What does go on between the ears of a performer when they're in competition? And is it the same for everybody? Would everybody respond in the same way? How do I know? How am I going to find out? I want to know. And those were the sorts of questions that really got me intrigued about psychology, our mental game, our human condition. You know, and that's sort of driven my curiosity about people, trying to understand people and help people perform better, help them, you know, grasp their mental game and engineer their headspace so that they can perform at their best. Yeah, that was the sort of genesis of it,
That was
really.
it. Yeah, brilliant. Yeah. So we'll go on to mental game next time, but a couple of things I wanted to, first of all, the dog trainers will be very interested in the whole those theories that you talked about there, because they're ever so similar to what we go through with dogs as well. You know, getting them that sort of can't remember the exact phrase that you used now, you know, but the different theories that you mentioned, when if getting the arousal thing, you know, getting the dog, like if the dog goes past that point, then it's game over kind of thing, you know. And yeah, so very interested in that. Well, the dog trainers, they'll be wanting to know more about that anyway. But I'll go back even further just for a second. Something that you said about when you were at university and you with the rugby team, you know, where you kind of thought outside the box of, about you know, playing in the stadium, getting the sponsors, all this kind of thing. I think you were saying they'd said it never, it wasn't been done. It hadn't been done because it hadn't been done before. But I guess you just looked at, well, like professional. Obviously, it is being done, isn't it? But it's just being done by professional teams. You know what I mean? They have sponsors and stuff like that. It reminded me of something that Dan Kennedy teaches, which is about like modeling. you know, if you want to achieve things that the big boys are achieving, you know, you need to kind of take on some of the traits, model some of the traits of the big boys before you're a big boy kind of thing, you know. And that's one way to kind of pull yourself up, isn't it, to that, like, that level.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and I suspect most people would reflect on their own experience and see this also, that we are limited by ourselves, usually. If we think something's beyond us, it will be beyond us.
Yeah.
If we think it's possible, then it's probably possible for us. And, you know, I used to look at things, and still very much do, and think, well, could we do that? How do we know we can't? Has anybody ever tried? And that, I guess, is the start point. It doesn't mean that it's going to work first time. You know, it doesn't mean that the first letter that you ever write for sponsorship will be successful and somebody will come back and say yes, or that everything will be very, you know, smooth and easy. But I think, you know, I had a tendency to start with those sorts of questions. Rather than closing off the possibility by thinking, well, you know, why would anyone want to sponsor us? Because if you ask that kind of question, the inevitable answer you probably get back is, well, nobody. Nobody'd want to, because we're just a tiny little university rugby team and nobody's ever sponsored us before and nobody sponsors any of the other sports teams at this university. So, you know, why would they? As opposed to, they might, possibly. Yeah. Has anybody asked?
Yeah. Because the might can lead you down all kinds of paths, doesn't it? Whereas nobody does it doesn't lead you anywhere at all. It's just like, right, that's that. It's the end of the discussion. So right, let's go into mindset then, because this is something that we've had somebody else talk about a bit on a teleclass. I feel like I personally have undergone some big kind of mindset shifts. Always difficult for me to say those words without swearing. Over the last kind of 18 months, I think one of the reasons why I'm very choosy about who I invite on is because you'll probably know better than anybody. There's a lot of like woo out there, isn't there? And there's a lot of like happy clappy stuff out there, you know, from people who, well, I don't know. To me, a lot of the people out there preaching this haven't really. They haven't done much in their own like businesses even, do you know what I mean? But you yourself coming from where you've came from, this is why I wanted to get you on to talk about how big a thing this whole mindset thing is, and how, you know, how what lies between our ears is the thing that's holding us back a lot of the time from, you know, reaching our potential, isn't it, in our business or whatever, especially our business, I suppose, with what we're talking about here.
Yeah, when I started working with professional athletes, and I was really only just out of university when I started working with elite and professional athletes, a couple of things struck me. First of all, I wanted to know what made the difference between the great athletes and the others. And again, my hard science background, my physiology and biomechanics, sort of suggested that it might be that the quickest athlete was going to be the tallest because they had the longest limbs or something like that. And the reality is they weren't the best. Not always, not consistently. So then I had to dig a little bit deeper and find out, okay, well, what is the difference consistently? What's the difference between all of these athletes, the common denominator? And I started to notice that it was their mindset, their mental game. Over the years, I've started to differentiate mental game from character. The mental game, I think, if you get the mental game right, you will consistently perform at your best. When you get character right, your best gets better and better and better and better. And they had a combination of those. So I started to then ask, well, what is it? What are they doing differently? When I first started working with them, honestly, when I came out of university, I did what most people would do. I started trying to apply the textbook, and it didn't work consistently, not predictably for everybody. And that's a real problem if you're working in elite sport, because it's all about results. You know, I'm a very process person. I definitely think process first and the outcome follows. However, if you're not delivering results, you're not going to be there very long, is the harsh reality of life. So I had to find methods that worked consistently. I had to find them fairly quickly. Methods that worked consistently for every athlete that I was working with, and it was going to tangibly improve their performance, and not just short term but long term. I also knew that they couldn't depend on me standing next to them to be able to provide them with an answer. They had to be independent, because, you know, the reality of life is I can't be standing next to all of them all of the time. I need to give them the tools so that they can engineer their own mental game. And very quickly, I started to develop methods that I could trust. And ultimately, you know, if you're going to do this as a profession, then, you know, your mortgage is going to depend on this, ability to feed kids and partners and all those sorts of things. That's going to depend on this as well. So it has to be ultimately trustworthy in that respect. So, yeah, there wasn't a great deal of margin for error, if I'm honest. So I had to get it right fairly quickly.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And so how, before we talk about where we start with it, with the mindset, how sort of debilitating can it be? I know it's obviously going to be very debilitating, but have you got any stories of how having the wrong mindset or not, you know, being prepared mentally has affected performance?
Yeah, I mean, in some cases, it does have a very, very drastic effect. I worked with a cricketer once who was so anxious that he was a spin bowler. So he would put the ball in his hand, he would get his
very
grip.
Very much a confidence thing, isn't it? Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. He'd get his grip, his arm would whirl round, and one day he looked down the track to see where the ball was, and there was no ball. And then he looked down at his hand, and the ball was still in his hand. So this was in a competitive game. He was so anxious that he physically couldn't release the ball. There's a term within psychology and sports psychology known as the yips. And you know, it's when golfers can't hit a putt properly, dart throwers can't release the dart out of their hand properly. There are other, you know, one of the other athletes I worked with was a trampolinist who couldn't time the exit out of their somersault, so they kept just going round in a ball and ended up bouncing off the bed, you know, still touching the ball, because they were so anxious they just didn't do the thing that they'd been doing it for years, and you know, by theory it should be natural, because they were anxious and because their mind wasn't working with them, it was working against them. So they're kind of extreme forms where people find that because their mental game's going wrong, it's actually stopping them doing something that they've been able to do for years and years and years.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because I think we think of, I'm quite a confident person, and my team, my guys tell me that, I don't know, I think it's one of my strengths, I think, you know, it rubs off on them a bit and stuff as well. But we talk about confidence as being like you have it or you don't, sometimes, but I guess we never think about what you've just said there, where you can lose it, can't you, as well, you know, it could be something that you just, well you can either lose it quite quickly like that, or you can lose it over time, can't you?
Oh, absolutely. Equally, you can cultivate it, and you can grow confidence if you understand how.
Let's talk about that then.
Yeah, I mean, I don't talk about boosting confidence. I talk about controlling confidence, which essentially means bringing confidence back under our control again. Most people rely on things that are outside of their control to drive their confidence. Ultimately, confidence is built on evidence. It's not built on pep talks or affirmation cards or, you know, kind of sitting cross-legged saying, I can do it, I can do it, I can do it. That's not real confidence. That's not true confidence. True confidence comes from evidence. And sometimes we rely on bits of evidence that are outside of our control or sources that are outside of our control. So, for example, if you rely on results to drive your confidence, the result is always going to be outside of your control. The outcome is always outside of your control. So for an athlete, if they rely on winning or losing to drive their confidence, and the referee makes a bad decision today and we lose, then by definition, our confidence is going to fall. So I asked the question, well, who's got the remote control then for confidence? And if in that situation, it would be the referee. So you've just handed the remote control for your confidence over to the referee. Essentially, you've said to the referee, you decide whether I can be confident or not, because you're going to dictate the outcome of this contest. If we rely on other people's feedback or other people's input, what other people say to us, we just handed them the remote control for our confidence. So controlling confidence is all about taking that back, and understanding that win, lose or draw, I'm going to control my confidence. Or regardless of what you say or what you think, I'm going to control my confidence. So that's when we start doing that, then we can cultivate our own confidence. But until we do that, it's outside of our control. And to be honest, we're hoping that we can be confident.
Mm. So where do we start then?
Well, with confidence, it's understanding that there's a massive difference between judging the result or judging yourself based on the result and evaluating your performance honestly and objectively. Most people judge themselves based on the result or judge themselves based on other people's feedback. That's confidence that's outside of your control. And in lots of cases, that can kind of lead to insanity. Mm-hmm. If we take the control back and we honestly and objectively evaluate our own performance, and we start with a question, well, what did I do and how well did I do it? It's not a judgment. So the words good or bad can't come into this because that's a judgment.
Yes.
We have to look at what we did well, what we need to improve, what we're going to go and work on, and then commit to working on the things that we need to work on. And if we do that, we'll be confident that next time we'll be better than we were this time. And it doesn't matter, you know, I use it a simple 0 to 10 scale. So it honestly doesn't matter whether we score ourselves a 2 out of 10 today or an 8 out of 10 today. The questions are the same. What made our performance 2 and not 0? Because there's some stuff you did that's pretty good and you're going to keep. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. So let's understand that first. Then let's work out the gap between 2 and 10 and not ask ourselves to leap to 10, because that's not going to work. That's not possible. So let's just ask, how do we get better than a 2? What do we need to go away and work on? And if we work on it, we're confident that we'll come back and we'll deliver a higher than 2 out of 10 performance next time. And then we'll go through exactly the same thing. If we come back and we're a 4 or a 5 out of 10, same 2 questions. What made it a 5, not a 0? What's the gap? What are we going to keep working on? Let's go away and work on that then. And let's come back next time and we might be a 6, 7, something like that. Great. Let's do it again. And keep working through that iterative process, because lots of our confidence actually is drawn on the knowledge that we are progressing and getting better. And it's that we know we are, not hope we are. We know we're getting better.
I guess, well, self-awareness to a degree, but tracking then is going to be huge, isn't it? You know, tracking what you're doing, you know, tracking what you're doing to as part of the process, you know, rather than just coasting. And if you don't know what you've done to get you where you are, then you can't change any of it, can you?
No, sure. Being really aware of our progress and how we're improving is critical. Yeah. Yeah. Mm. Which we only do when we take time out to genuinely reflect on our performance. You know, I do quite a lot of keynote speaking. If I come off stage at the end of a keynote, or I've been delivering a workshop or whatever, and as I'm driving home, I'll think to myself, so, you know, how was that? And just work my way through, you know, how well did I deliver what I intended to deliver? How well did I respond to the audience? Was it the right content? How well did I prepare? How well did I know my material? You know, all of that sort of stuff. And it's all process orientated. What I don't ask is, did the audience like it or not? Because I can't control that. If somebody once asked me, how do you impress the audience? I said, well, I don't try. You know, I've just got to do what I do, and they'll decide whether they're impressed or not. You know, that bit's out of my control.
Removes a lot of pressure, I suppose, doesn't it, going into it with that kind of attitude as well?
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, your only job really is to do your job, not control the outcome. You never will be able to control the outcome. So, you know, there's very little point trying.
Yeah, I've had this drummed into me by a previous mentor as well about this whole, you know, just concentrate on the process and you know, that you can't, like you said, you can't control the results, can you, really? You know, you can't control the results. You can only control the process, can't you? And do your best. And you said, make sure that you did better last time.
And pressure, you know, what most people experience as pressure, is happens when we emotionally attach ourselves to one outcome or another. You know, I'm a huge believer that pressure can only exist in one place, and that's in our imagination. So the only way to experience pressure is to imagine it. And that we know that because pressures are related to something that's in the future, an outcome that's in the future. Mm-hmm. And the only way you can ever experience anything in life that's in the future is to imagine it. There's no other way to experience it. Yeah. We've got three ways of experiencing life: the past through our memory, the present through our senses and our thoughts, and the future through our imagination. And if we emotionally attach ourselves to an outcome that's in the future, so what we essentially do is we create two possible futures, one that we desperately want and one that we desperately don't want. And both of them are outside of our control. We don't know which one we're going to get, but we dearly want one and definitely not the other. And it's because we create that attachment to those outcomes, and then we try and engineer the outcome that we want and engineer ourselves away from the outcome we don't want, that we start experiencing pressure.
Cool. Yeah, no, we do. I'm drifting because I'm just thinking about times that I've done that myself in the past, you know, and yeah, you definitely put undue pressure on yourself, and then the result is like, it's never good enough then, isn't it? You know, so you know, you can't. Well, I've certainly felt like that. When it's where I've achieved something, because I've set the bar so bloody high for myself, you know, the huge success that I've had still feels like a bit of a letdown.
Yeah, it's the other thing that we tend to do is we put what I call the imaginary high jump bar in place. And that essentially is expectation, that high jump bar. And if we cross the high jump bar, we're pleased. And if we fall short of the high jump bar, we're disappointed. And a lot of people, I'll say to them, look, you know, the high jump bar is also imaginary. It's a product of your imagination. It's fantasy. And they say, you know, should I lower it or higher it? No, just don't put it there. And they'll say, yeah, but I've got really high standards. That's not the same as expectation. You know, those two words get confused. They're not the same thing. You can have massively high standards and zero expectation.
Is it possible to have massively high targets as well, or is that similar?
You can have targets. I mean, my view of goals sounds a bit contrary. I think they're really useful and completely useless both at the same time. Really useful in that process goals can keep us on track. Absolutely. They give us an idea of where we're going and what we're trying to achieve. Absolutely. That's fine. Useless in that most targets end in a round number. And, you know, a round number is just a round number. I worked with a swimmer once, and to achieve a world-class standard, he would have to swim 100 meters in under 60 seconds. That would probably get him on an Olympic program, get him on a funded Olympic program, so he'd be a full-time athlete. It would put him into finals of major competitions, Olympics and world championships and things like that. So most people were targeting under 60 seconds, but we weren't. Our target was for him to swim as fast as he possibly could. Because in all honesty, why would we have any other target?
Yeah.
It would be stupid to have a different target than as fast as you possibly can. Forget the number. The number's irrelevant. Just swim as fast as you possibly can. When you go under 60 seconds, you'll be in the world-class group. But focusing on being under 60 seconds is irrelevant. You know, that's the point at which I say goals are useless.
No, I like. Let's stay with the pool theme then, okay. and move on to the. Obviously, I was doing a bit of research, yourself, been watching some of the videos on YouTube and on your website and stuff, which are awesome. Alex had previously told me about the two lengths of the pool concept, you know, and we are. It's difficult. It's difficult for anybody, but particularly difficult for entrepreneurs, like, not to be distracted by bright shiny objects, you know, that keep cropping up all the time, don't they? It can pull us off target, you know. And so I think one of the reasons I get so much stuff done in my business is I'm fairly focused, you know. I could be better probably, but I'm fairly good at focusing down and getting stuff done. So this two lengths of the pool thing really quite resonated quite a bit with me, you know. So why don't you tell us about the story about how that came about and sort of the practical applications that it can have for people?
Yeah, sure. So Chris, who was that 100 meter swimmer?
I watched the video. Yeah, fab.
Yeah, he he and I worked together for 7 years. So we started in about 2001. His last competitive race was the Beijing Olympic final in 2008. And embarrassingly, you know, we'd worked together for about 3 years before we actually understood his job. He's a 100 meter swimmer. He swims in a 50 meter pool. Actually, it doesn't take much to work out what his job really is. But we got confused. So for the first 2 or 3 years, we thought his job was to win. Or maybe to make the British team, or perhaps to get some sponsorship or win some medals or get funding or whatever. And none of those things were his job. His job was simply to swim two lengths of the pool as fast as he possibly could. That was it. That was his job. And he became incredibly effective when we understood that, and he started using that understanding. So he would ask a question very simply: how much of the stuff that I do every day, every week, helps me to swim two lengths of the pool as fast as possible? And he scrutinized his training program. He was doing, you know, 60, 70,000 meters a week in the pool. He said, how many of these meters help me swim 100 meters quicker? And the answer was not all of them. Hmm. He did the same. He went into the gym, the weights room, and he said to his strength and conditioning coach one day, he said, why do I lie on my back on the bench and push the bar out when swimming, I pull the water towards me? And the strength and conditioning coach said, I don't know. Mm. So, well, why am I doing it? Well, because everybody does it. Yeah, but should I be doing it? Probably not. And so he scrutinized his training program and ditched 60%+ of all the things that he'd ever been doing because they didn't contribute. And I asked this same question in businesses, to other sports teams, to, you know, entrepreneurs, to golfers, tennis players, whatever. And consistently they'll come back and say, probably 60-70% of all the things I do don't really contribute. Mm. If I ask people in a you know, typical, you know, sort of £1 billion organization in a big corporation, how many of the emails, how many of the phone calls, how many of the meetings, how many of all of the things that you do actually contribute to you doing your job better? And it'll be the same. 62/3, whatever, doesn't contribute.
Yeah.
So immediately, if we can get that understanding of what does and doesn't contribute, and we can start to really focus down on the things that make a difference, then we can be incredibly effective. And, you know, when Chris and I understood this, quite honestly, he was not a real contender in the British team. He was not really on the radar. He certainly wasn't a world-class athlete, but when he finished his career, he'd become a double Olympian, a double Commonwealth champion and double Commonwealth gold medal record holder. He was an Olympic finalist, seventh fastest in history in his event, because really he'd become incredibly effective and dedicated everything that he did towards swimming two lengths of the pool as fast as possible. And in doing so, made some really quite unusual decisions. When you compared him to his peers, so he would decide not to go to an awards dinner because although you can meet sponsors there, it means you get to bed later and then it means that your training's not as good the day after. So why would you do that? Because it's not going to help you swim two lengths of the pool. It's probably going to make you slower. Mm. You know, lots of decisions. He turned down a massive sponsorship deal because he would have to wear the swimsuit from the sportswear company and it made him 0.1 seconds slower.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So yeah,
tons of analogies there, isn't there? You know, not all business is good business and stuff for you. But so I guess is the thing, it's brilliant, by the way, it's fascinating. Is the thing to take away to find out what your two lengths of the pool are, and then to try and identify everything that you're doing that in contributing to that?
That's definitely a very, very powerful first step. Yeah, I mean, it's all about simplifying and clarifying. And cutting out the stuff that doesn't contribute, focusing highly on the stuff that does make a difference, mean, I also asked Chris to identify the five key things, the most important five, the five that had the biggest impact on his performance, the most significant five. And, you know, the idea was that there might not be only five, but let's work on the top five, because why would we work on six, seven or eight and try and improve those if we haven't nailed the top five yet, the five that have the biggest impact? Mm-hmm. And so we dedicated all of our time and effort to improving these five things. And again, that's actually quite rare. Yeah, you know, the secret to how people become world class in their field, it's not complicated at all. It's that they focus on improving those really important things and they do it consistently day after day after day. Most people don't. Most people just get up in the morning and do stuff.
Yeah.
And they're busy through their day. You know, they'll do stuff hopefully that earns them money and keeps them fed and all that sort of stuff. But they don't really genuinely improve the most important areas of their performance day on day on day on day on day.
Yeah.
And those who do become world class.
Yeah. And partake of those key activities. This should be quite reassuring, I hope, to some of my guys listening to this, because we talk about like 80-20 a lot, which this sounds like it's, you know, it's along those lines, isn't it? You know, of focusing on the things that you should be doing, get rid of the things that aren't contributing to your goals, but also the whole, like, you know, planning better. And well, I always encourage my guys to go to bed on a Sunday, you know, with the three things written down that they want to get done on the Monday. You know, don't just wait until the Monday, you know, and to drift through the day, because shit will happen, won't it? You know, stuff will come along and take up your time if you're not careful. Certainly just for me anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the other thing that's we did with our group of entrepreneurs out in Dublin at the beginning of November is to look at how you turn ideas into results. And most people,
actually, just to interrupt you, that was a big thing that Alex came away with when I asked him. I said, what was your big takeaway? And that was what he said.
Most people, if they're honest, they come up with an idea and then probably start doing it. And they don't filter it at all to say, is this a good idea? What other ideas have I got? Have I got any better ideas? You know, the classic one that I often see in solo entrepreneurship is, right, I need to make some more money. So how can I do that then? Do I create a new program? Do I do some marketing? What could I do? And some ideas will spin off the top of their heads and then they'll start getting to work on them. Without really stepping back and going, okay, let's put loads of ideas down. Let's start working through them now to find out which are the really good ideas in here, which could have a massive impact. You know, if I was to grade them or rank them in some way, you know, they're not all going to be top. So how would they look? Let's just look at how much value they'll give me. Let's just look at whether this is a really good idea. Let's look at whether now's a good time to do it or not, you know, and just stress test it in some way and then flip that forward into an actual strategy, not a flurry of activity, because that's not the same as a strategy. Put it into a strategy and then start working the strategy up. Understanding that your plan may not, you know, your plan's only as good as, you know, or only last till first contact, as they say. So you may have to review it, replan it, reiterate it, go again a number of times before you actually become successful. And again, there are so few people who actually go through that process. Most come up with an idea and start doing stuff. And there's nothing in between those two things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, for sure. Yeah, 100%. And this is why we have so many, I suppose, half-assed, half-finished projects, isn't it? Never finished projects, because not a lot of thought's gone into, not a lot of planning's gone into it. And so we've rushed into it and, you know, it don't work. And then the same, you know, another thing happens, same thing happens again, doesn't it? You know, and it's, you can repeat this process many times, can't you?
And you know, I've asked, you know, entrepreneurs that I work with one very, very simple question a lot. Is this strategic or is this just an opportunity? And to start with, they say, well, what do you mean? I mean, well, does it fit in with your overall strategy or is it going to divert you? Oh, I don't know. Is this essentially a distraction by another name?
Yeah.
Because if you don't know what you should be doing and what your strategy is and what your two lengths of the pool are and how you can improve those that two lengths of the pool, you don't really know whether this thing that's in front of you right now is going to take you towards it or take you away from it. And lots of people create their own distractions. They just don't realize that's what they are. Because they're busy, they think they're productive, but those two things aren't the same, of course.
Busy fools. Yeah, definitely. Brilliant. We've got like 15 minutes left. Can we talk a bit about teams? And like I said, I think this, I feel like we're a strong sort of team anyway. My guys, you know, who I work with, but obviously they have their own, a lot of them have their own teams as well working underneath them, or they're building their own teams now. So yeah, just go through your how many is it? I can't remember. What are your points off for teams again, Sam? Is it five or six? Or
six.
Yeah, you're six. Yeah, bash us through them.
Okay, so
and where did this come from as well? Has this just come from working with teams?
Yeah, well, this has come from working with and studying world-class teams. Mm-hmm. So I spent lots of years, I mean, I've worked with lots and lots of sports teams, some of whom were world championship winning teams, European championship winning teams, you know, very successful international teams. Yeah. So some of it's come from that experience. Some of it's come from working with non-sports teams, like working with and studying SAS units and Red Arrows teams, Formula One pit crews, racing yacht crews, Michelin star kitchen teams, surgical teams, you know, all sorts of teams in a vast, you know, kind of wide, diverse range of fields. And I was looking for common characteristics that differentiate world-class teams from the rest. So I found six. The first one is that they are highly focused. Essentially, that means they've got a strong, clear, shared purpose. What it doesn't mean is that they have a common goal, because a common goal and a strong, clear, shared purpose are very, very different. Common goal is just a shared desire, you know, a shared outcome. A strong, clear, shared purpose means that we understand why we do what we do, why this is important, why this matters, why we have to do this well. Not just do it, but do it well. And it's not just something that we care about. I care about it, and you care about it, and you care about it. So we individually care about it as well as collectively. That's a sort of a foundation for a world-class team.
And is that difficult to instill? Is that difficult to find in like a more corporate structure, or not really?
It's not easy. It takes a lot of thought. Ridiculously, you know, executive teams, I often work with boards of directors in corporations, and they'll start off thinking, oh, you know, this won't take us very long. And then, you know, sort of three and a half hours later, they'll finally arrive at it and they'll go, well, that's obvious. How on earth did it take us that long to get here? But they've spent two or three hours, you know, just debating between themselves. So yeah, it's not easy to find. Simplification's never easy. Simplification's effortful usually. Overcomplication's very easy. And usually finding a target's very simple, but a purpose, that's not quite so simple and easy. So yeah, it does take effort, but it's
worth doing.
Definitely worth doing, and it's definitely possible.
Yeah.
So that's the first characteristic. Second is that they have shared standards and expectations. They can all look at something in the same way and agree on whether it's good enough or not good enough. And when you can't do that, you get into trouble, because somebody will be performing at a level that they think is good enough, but it might not be to everybody else. So if it's good enough to them, they're not going to change it. Mm-hmm. So we have to have that understanding of what good enough looks like, and a shared understanding of what good enough looks like. The third characteristic is that they have a total appreciation for each individual. And this means that they understand, as I describe it, the size and the shape of their cog in the machine and everybody else's cog, and how they all fit together, and why every single one of them is absolutely vital to make that machine work. The fourth is that they draw strength from their diversity. They understand that there is difference between them. And I'm not, when I talk about diversity, I'm not just talking about gender diversity or racial or whatever. Yeah. I'm talking about usually the difference in personality, that people solve problems differently. So they don't always perceive things the same way, that they wouldn't solve the problem the same way. And that gives us both simultaneously our greatest strength and also potentially our greatest weakness. The difference could either be the frustration that tears us apart, or it can be the thing that allows you to almost balance out my weakness, your strength to balance out my weakness. The fifth is that they have what they term a brutal honesty, and I call a complete honesty. So they're very happy being completely honest with each other. Most people, and in most teams, you see incomplete honesty, not complete honesty. Incomplete meaning they'll tell you part of what they should say, and they'll sugarcoat it to a point where it loses the meaning, and they don't actually tell you what they should tell you. So a complete honesty is the fifth. The sixth,
I would imagine that will come out a lot with the sports teams, wouldn't it? I guess that, you know, I saw the All Blacks thing that you talked about and stuff. You know, they're honest, aren't they? Yeah, the best teams that they're on, that they're honest with each. You know, they're just giving their all, aren't they? Yeah.
Well, the All Blacks have a lovely little phrase: "Stab me in the front." It's it's an understanding that, you know, I want you to tell me if you've got critical feedback. Stabbing me in the back would be going to tell somebody else how I can be better, or what I'm doing wrong. But this is stronger than permission. This is a request. They're asking each other, give me your feedback. I want it. If you know something that can help me get better, tell me, because that'll help me get better and that'll help us get better. So, and if you don't tell me, you're doing me and us a disservice. So they've got this real understanding of the value of complete honesty. They're very happy to challenge each other and be challenged by each other. They're very happy to give and take critical feedback. Even when it looks to the rest of the world like, you know, they'd be wincing listening to this feedback. But the people involved just understand it's a way to get better. And we all want to get better. So this is just fine.
Sorry, I interrupted you there. Sorry. Point five.
Yeah. So the final one, again, this one sounds really obvious, but it's actually very rare. They're always learning. The truth is most teams are sometimes learning, and some of them are often learning, but very, very few of them are always learning. So this means literally they're going to squeeze every ounce of benefit they can from every single experience. Most of these teams debrief on a daily basis or sometimes multiple times a day. Most businesses that I've encountered have a sometimes monthly, sometimes quarterly, sometimes end of project review, and they don't really learn that much when they do it. Whereas world-class teams are always learning. They have a thorough, regular, focused debrief, and they spin out whatever they learn, they spin out that into the next iteration and make sure they improve from it. And that's really rare.
I guess what jumps into my mind most recently, well, you have much wider experience than me, but I just read, I've forgotten his name now, the guy who just won the Tour de France, and obviously Sky, the team Sky, they're meticulous with that, aren't they? With the debriefing and stuff, it's like every little thing is being measured and tweaked and tested, you know, all of the time. But I guess you'll see that throughout the sporting world, won't you?
Yeah, and lots of the non-sports teams. I mean, the best team that I ever saw do this are the Red Arrows.
And
with many of my clients, with the corporate clients particularly, and some of the sports teams, we start to develop what we call a Red Arrows review. And it's just taking the principles that the Red Arrows use to debrief and dropping that into their organization.
Cool. So how, just on a slightly different note then, the brilliant, the team thing, I think it's fantastic. How did you go about getting invited to speak to these teams and stuff, you know? What did you just ask permission?
A lot of the time.
I knew that was going to be the answer, but
you have to have something of value to offer them.
For sure.
Some of them I was already working with. Some of them I wasn't. Some of them I, you know, were new teams to me. But you'd be amazed if you walk into. So one of the crews that I wasn't working with previously were a racing yacht crew. And when I spoke to they were an America's Cup crew. And when I spoke to the race team manager and I said, I'd love to come and study what you guys do and work with you. I'm also working with and studying Red Arrows teams, SAS units, Formula One pit crews and things like that. Yeah. And none of you compete with each other. So they're all happy for me to share what they do with you on the understanding that I can also share what you do with them. Are you interested? Mm. And most of them said, yeah, sounds great. Yeah, we'd love to learn what the Red Arrows do and what makes the Formula One pit crew work. And
because they're always learning, aren't they? They know that they're, even though they're at the peak of their powers kind of thing, you know, the absolute elite of theirs, they know there's still stuff to be learned from other people.
Absolutely. So, and they also know that, you know, because they're non-competing organizations, if I said to them, you know, we'll get half a dozen of you guys together, you know, we'll get one of the SAS guys and a Red Arrows team leader and a, you know, the race team manager from the Formula One pit crew and you and, you know, somebody else, Michelin star chef or whatever, and we'll have an afternoon talking teams. Do you fancy that? Yeah, most of them do. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it wasn't that difficult. I mean, there were some teams that said no and some of the leaders said not interested and all that sort of stuff. That's fine. But many of them were interested because they knew what they could gain from it.
Yeah, superb. Simon, this has been a fantastic chat. I want to finish off by asking you, what drives you then? What keeps you going now? What are your passions lie? What's the future hold?
It has always been, and I think it will always continue to be, curiosity.
I knew you were going to say that. Brilliant. Yeah.
I mean, I have a funny feeling that I will never come to the end of learning about human nature. We're incredibly complex, intricate beings. So understanding people, understanding performance, understanding what makes people and organizations world class, how we become successful, how we perform at our best. You know, I can't see a point where I'll think, do you know, I think I've learned everything now. So I suspect that will keep me going for a while.
Cool. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And what are the plans for yourself and the Success Engineer stuff from a business point of view? What are you hoping to achieve next year and further ahead?
So Success Engineers, we've got a couple of events outlined around March time. I think we're going to be in Glasgow looking at how you create essential business discipline. So we're looking at, you know, how you create financial discipline and dashboards and metrics for your business, but also how you become a more disciplined person. Mm-hmm. So we're doing that. We're also going to be in New York in May. I'm not entirely sure what our focus is in New York yet, but we'll be there. We've got the event from Dublin is going to be released as a digital product. Mm-hmm. So that people who weren't there essentially can be there without being there, but they can learn everything that we all learned in Dublin. The same with the Rome event, that's going to be released as a digital because Alex is waving his magic wand all over both of those. We've got a product called the Accountability Engine launching in 2019, which, unlike many other approaches to accountability, the aim of this is to allow you to develop personal responsibility, self-responsibility, so that you don't need external accountability. Mm-hmm. So that comes out in 2019. So yeah, we've got all sorts of things bubbling away.
Cool, you have. Yeah, fantastic. And out of you've written a good few books, where would you recommend people start? What would be
start with your interest. they're all different. Peak Performance Every Time is all about your mental game. How to Shine is all about the characteristics of world-class individual performers. Could I Do That's all about how to take on massive challenges, the challenges that most people would think of as impossible, how you take on those sorts of challenges. Two Lengths of the Pool is all about that little concept of simplifying and clarifying what you do. Stronger Together is about the teams. How to Herd Cats is about how you lead people through, lead through influence. How to Develop Character does what it says on the tin. And Master Mental Toughness does what it says on the tin. So they're all different. And they're, yeah, they're all, whatever you think would help you most, start there.
Cool. And they can, you, the guys can get them from Amazon?
Oh, yes. Yeah. As with most things in life now, I think. I don't know what you can't buy on Amazon.
No, definitely not. Hey, Simon, this has been superb. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. I've learned loads. I know the guys listening will learn loads as well. So I want to thank you for your time. I'd love to have you on again, maybe later on in the year, to talk about some of the stuff that you've been doing in 2019 as well. But yeah, this has been absolutely awesome. Thanks so much. And yeah, I wish you all the best.
Thank you very much.